Group meeting, Friday, 5th August, 1983.
Religious living is holiness in action. Let us consider that. What does holiness mean? It means that wholeness, that state of wholeness, which is the complete harmony of the whole man as he is, as an existential being in the world. So, quite simply, it would mean the harmony of the body and psyche and the intellectual activities and so forth. This is the perishable part of us. The imperishable is that which is the unknown, and it is unknowable by any sort of brain activity, by thinking, as we call it, or by meditating in the commoner garden sense of the word meditating, which simply means musing, talking silently with oneself, in the quiet, of course. But all that talking is completely determined, is predetermined by our sense impressions. We can't talk outside our sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and so on. It is all that which has been named by us and forms the vocabulary which we use. And it is that vocabulary which we keep turning round and round. So now all this is the perishable part, including our consciousness as it is at present. Namely, it is a discriminative consciousness. By discriminative, I do not mean that which discerns the real, the true, contained in whatsoever is present here in the perishable world. That is insight, true discernment, which is something quite different. But our consciousness is discriminative. And you will find that this discriminative consciousness, vijnana is the Pali word for it. Don't mix it up with the Sanskrit vijnana. Vijnana, the Pali word, stands for this discriminativeness which separates out that which is painful from that which is pleasurable and so on, which analyzes all the time, which splits up the unity of our living experience. So that is discriminative consciousness. And our existential existence, that is to say, we as existential beings, compose psychophysical organisms as such, have a body, and we have our feelings, our thoughts, our mental patterns, our predilections, and so forth, and this discriminative consciousness associated with all these aspects of our being. And this whole the totality of the existential being is the completely perishable part. Now, this perishable being is actually transcendence itself, which by self-constriction has become the perishable. Transcendence, the imperishable, that which belongs and constitutes the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, by its own self-constriction becomes all the perishable aspect, which is manifestation. The total manifested universe is the perishable, is a perishable thing. We all know that. And modern science completely corroborates all those things. You may remember at our group's summer school last year, in one of my talks, I mentioned the sort of timetable of eternity which Professor Edwin Turner of Princeton, I think, gave in answer to a question of what was the probable lifetime of the universe as such. And he suggested as the final stage that in about 10 to the power 1,000 or 2,000 years, our years as measured by us, the universe will have completely disappeared into eternal silence, the eternal void. It's rather strange that he should use the word eternal that way. But still, there it is. On the whole, this is the general consensus of opinion, that this is all the perishable. Now, it is through this existential being that we have to learn, we have to try and discover what is the culminating point, or the goal, if you like to use that word, of our human evolution, our evolution as members of the human species. And as we discover that and live in that manner which expresses the vision, at least a reasonably true vision of that goal, we release wholeness in our life, health in the true sense of the word, perfect health, perfect wholeness, which is the harmony of all the aspects composing our existential being. And that type of wholeness is the state of holiness. Because in that state of wholeness, we begin to transcend the nature of our consciousness at present, which is the analytical, discriminative, unity-disrupting consciousness. We begin to transcend that and begin to be aware of the that consciousness which is at home in the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. All this is the finite, the temporal, the mortal. So, you see, that state of consciousness is the supremely holy state. And those who have realized that, this is not sort of spun out by me, or by any writer or thinker in our day or in past days, but it is something which has been realized, that means made real, made an actuality in the lives of those people who became the perfected holy ones. You see? So now, when that stage is realized, then one is living all day long, all 24 hours, waking, sleeping, anytime, anywhere, in a religious manner. Consider a simple analogy. Supposing you have a gift as a for writing poetry, that you had it from your childhood, we'll say you could write some pretty verses. As you grow, and if you're gifted with genius as a poet, that genius will gradually come to flower ultimately. Your poetry will become great poetry, which will live, which will not be waste paper basket material someday. You see, it will be real poetry. And then your writing really is poetical. So your poetry, your poetical life from within and in expression begins when you have realized the stage of writing perfect poetry. It's the same with a musician, a great composer. His real musicianship, living the music, the life of the musician begins when he has attained supreme mastery. This is extraordinarily well illustrated in the life of Beethoven, because you know how musicologists talk of the three stages: the early works till about the opus 50, and then particularly from the Waldstein Sonata onwards, right up to opus past the 8th symphony. That's his so-called middle period, in which he displays the most remarkable personal mastery of his art. And that would correspond in our human life with the realization of true egohood. The true egohood is devoid of egoism. But one has realized consciously, and consciously lives in accordance with that realization, the harmony of all the elements composing the existential being, the particular body, psyche, etc., etc. You see? So that's that second period of Beethoven. And then he enters into that period, which the third period, which everyone knows. That in that period he produced music which really was touched transcendence itself. It was simply too marvelous. And if oneself has been fortunate enough to have his own sense of transcendence begin to awake, to thrill in response, then he would know exactly what I mean when I say that this was the period where he not only touched transcendence, but manifested transcendence through his late works, especially starting with the opus 101 onwards, right to the very end. So now, like that, religious living begins with holiness. It's not the end point. It begins with holiness in action. Now I say in action because action is the ultimate expression, the final manifestation of what has been actually realized in innermost consciousness. That is the stage where knowing, knowledge, has become pure vision. It has transcended all modes of expression in terms of words, thoughts, arts, philosophy, science, or anything, and you transcend that. So if you are really conscious of anything, then that which you are really conscious of will naturally, spontaneously express itself through all your thought, feeling, speech, and physical deed. It will naturally do that. So now, religious living is holiness in action, and that's what I mean by action. So it involves the development of consciousness to that state, to that stage. It has evolved to a culminating point, expressing itself in your everyday thought and feeling, and it expresses itself spontaneously, naturally, without the brain having to say, now, beware, you have to so and so, you have to do this or refrain from that. All those conflicts are out. You see, if, for instance, you suddenly became the sun, you wouldn't have any problem of sort of sending out heat, light, etc., etc. It would just happen, wouldn't it? Because you are the sun. And that's that. It's like that. Now, when we look at our development and evolution that way, we will be free of a thousand absurdities which spoil our lives. We would have no ambitions. There's no need to have any ambition to achieve it, because that is a self-centered thing that denies the totality. It denies transcendence. Ambition, the striving, achieving, attaining, all those things just go out. Naturally, it is that, and it happens. Now you see, that is the life of ease, isn't it? It's an easy life that way. It is easy for me to say it in words, but believe me, it's frightfully difficult. You know, it's like some of these Bach fugues. They, in the hands of the perfect pianist, they sound so simple, so easy, so wonderful. But they are remarkably complex structures. Remarkably complex. But not complicated. The ill state is the complicated state. The organism, our human organism, is a very complex organism as such. But the underlying principles of its life are utterly simple principles. So it's like that. Now, so I hope we have got something to consider quietly when we feel like considering it. Religious living is holiness in action, and it involves the evolution of our consciousness to a certain culminating point, which enables us to live like that. Now, of course, we learn all this in what we may call the school of life. We study books, we study scriptures, we go to teachers, gurus, and whatnot, and we think, now I shall be able to learn the truth from so and so. This man is an authority, or that woman is the saint, and so forth. You learn nothing. You think you'll learn. You may be helped to find yourself tackling certain problems in life more easily. But the real learning will always come out of your own constitution, out of your own being, your own being. Your best teacher is your own physical body. Study the body carefully. Not merely physiology, anatomy and all that. That's very helpful, because it will show you how the body, how the so-called different members of the body coordinate with each other, help each other, and they all do it naturally, spontaneously, because that is the law of their being. The bloodstream will do this, the heart will do that, and the cells will do this. Take a cell, a single cell. It has natural power to the natural power of self-motivation, self-reproduction, and self-healing, making whole. Healing means making whole, making holy. So if you can study your own body in the right way, learn these things and see, coordinate them with the life of the psyche, the constant flow of thoughts and feelings every day and throughout the day. And you will find that that will teach you what no other person can teach you. Another person may just help you in a way which is like the name of the street, which is at the beginning of the street, a road sign saying, you go this way, you'll get to Cambridge, you go that way, you'll get to Brighton, and so on and so on. That is all. But you go that way, go on that way, and you will know the way, won't you? The way which you tread yourself is the way which you really know. And the way which we tread as beings, the real being, is through this organism as such. This is our teacher, this is the path. The path is this itself, all the time. And if we can see that, then this will become quiet, it will become peaceful, it will be not your servant, but you will see the Supreme Self, which is the total self of the universe, embodied in here, and you will find that it will be in harmony with that totality. Again, as I say, it's easy to talk like this. It's very difficult to live it. However, difficulty, failure, as we call it, sorrow, are all absolutely necessary, because they present a challenge. They present a stimulus which helps us to wake up to reality, to wake up to truth. And so they are perhaps sometimes, perhaps often, more useful than the good things, the comfortable things, the successful things. Somebody who loves you will always say nice things to you. Somebody who doesn't may, not necessarily out of spite, but out of annoyance or whatever it is, tell you the truth about yourself, which is more helpful than what your friend tells you. You see? If you study, for example, the Vinaya Pitaka, the book of the discipline, which is in six huge volumes, you see, if you study that carefully, you will see how the Buddha sometimes says the most terrible things to his bhikkhus, his monks, who have erred, made mistakes, serious mistakes, or even slight mistakes. He says gentle things for the slight mistakes, but he says, really, it makes you shiver. But remember that the true teacher is one who is utterly compassionate and wise. So you mustn't picture him ranting and raving at the erring disciple. It's not like that. He always says it very quietly, very impressively, so that it goes straight to the heart of the person, his inner consciousness, and not only to his brain. So we have to bear that in mind too. Now, I said that a few moments ago that sorrow and such things are necessary to awaken us to truth, to reality. And it may be interesting to put things this way. Responding to the prick of dukkha, sorrow. You know the Pali terms? Responding to the prick of dukkha, of sorrow, decides your entrance to the school of life. When we are hurt, when we suffer, there comes the point when we stop trying to take it in our stride. It hurts too much. And when the hurt is sufficiently great, then we wake up and say, now why is this? How does this happen? What on earth am I to do about it? And so forth. So then you really start looking. You start considering. You start trying to understand the life process in its actuality as manifested through your daily life. We might, of course, run to some friend, to some teacher, some book or something, or scripture or whatever it is, and try to find the answer. But that, whilst helpful in a minor degree, is not the real way. Look within yourself. You are the living person. Life is inside you. And the life process at this moment is something which is hurting me, painful. Why? How? And you will begin to know yourself. You know how in Plato's Academy, Gnothi se auton, know thyself, was the motto. The Rig Veda put that in a profounder form, an altogether profounder form. It said, Atmanam Atmana Pashya. See the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. Atmanam, the accusative case. Atmana, by the instrumental case, by means of the Atma. Pashya, see. Observe the Supreme by means of the Supreme. Now you see the tremendous significance of that. It's something most worthwhile meditating on. And keep meditating on it. Then that is sort of step one. Step two. Saintship, the attainment of saintship, marks your matriculation with distinctions in the school of life. Saintship means right conduct, perfect conduct in thought and feeling, in speech, and in everyday action. So that includes the entire field of morality, of ethical living. You see? and thereby one has changed oneself, transmuted the lesser into, no, that's not a good word, transmuted the ill condition into the healthy condition, the bad condition into the good condition. And that is saintship. With saintship, you are now eligible for and entitled to enter the university of the spiritual life, of the religious life. If one continues and lives, of course it all depends on whether you remain alive or not, the culminating point is the Samma Sambodhi, the realization of the supreme enlightenment. By yourself, you are the self-enlightened one. We must remember, the light is within one. It is not outside one. There is light outside one also, in a sense, because that light which is within oneself is the light that is within anything and everything throughout the entire cosmos. But you can't enlighten yourself by somebody else's light. You become enlightened with your own light. If you take somebody else's, if you take a lamp, now look, that lamp casts a shadow of my head here, doesn't it? But if the light shines from within me, myself, then there is no shadow cast by me. So this Samma Sambodhi, the perfect self-enlightenment, is the culminating point. And that culminating point, you are the exemplar of humanity, the true, and you live the true human life, the happy or blissful creator. Because your influence through all your thought and feeling, your words and your deeds will have a truly creative influence for good on your entire environment. You won't know it, you won't see it. You may see a certain amount of the effects of it, but it will take place by itself, naturally, spontaneously, and inevitably, because you are what you are. Heat and light comes to us from the sun, inevitably. The sun can't say, I'm not going to shine today, or warm the planets or something today or tomorrow, and it doesn't do. It just is. Being what it is, all this happens. So you being supremely entitled, supremely enlightened, that is what will happen. This is the supreme way of healing the world's sorrow, of dissolving away its problems, and its battles and so forth. All that just disappears. This is the most powerful influence. I know that it would be very easy to challenge that this is the most powerful influence. But you see, very few people in the world today, truly few, you can count them at the most in dozens, no more, in a population of 4,000 millions. There are barely a few dozen people who understand the tremendous influence of the transmuted consciousness, when your consciousness has undergone that tremendous transmutation, it is functioning on the plane of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. And that influence seeps through everything, cleaning, healing, and bringing to fulfillment. Thank you.